This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Brine Field Services leader, Zalandez. And I have help spelling out Zalandez.com today. I'll leave it to you, Connor.
That's Zelandez.com.
I think Connor from New Zealand did a better job than Maddie from Money of Mine. Hi, it's Joe Lowry. Welcome to another episode of the Global Lithium Podcast. Today is episode 180. My guest is Andy Leyland, the founder of Supply Chain Insights. I have benefited greatly from Andy's work and his encyclopedic knowledge of the lithium-ion battery supply chain. When this hour is over, you will be much better informed, and I believe we'll be able to debunk a lot of the misinformation that is out there, both about lithium and the broader lithium-ion battery supply chain. Without further ado, Andy Leyland. Andy Leyland, welcome to the Global Lithium Podcast.
Hi, Joe. Great to be here.
I always like to start out with a backstory, so if you could tell us a little bit about where you're from and how you got to where you are today, it would be appreciated.
Sure. So I was born and raised in a place called Bromley, which is in the southeast of London. Nothing huge to report there. It was a pretty normal upbringing. From there, I went on to Oxford University, studied politics, philosophy, and economics there. And, you know, I finished uni and I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. So I was temping at a UK intelligence service. They don't normally take on temps, but this is just sort of post 9/11 and also Sarbanes-Oxley, which meant they suddenly had a huge backlog of work to do. Anyway, that was pretty dull. So me and a friend jumped on a plane and we decided to drive across America. And we were generally sort of delivering cars and things like this. So we ended up driving from West Point Military Academy, of all places, all the way over to San Francisco. When I got back to New York, I met up with a family friend. And we got very drunk in Battery Park in New York. And he was the head of research at a trading firm in New York. And he gave me 6 business cards to go and sort of talk to about careers. And one way or another, I've ended up working either with or for 5 of those. And because he was based in commodity research, that was kind of the beginning of my now 20-plus year career in commodity research. We've covered most of the metals and mining markets, base metals, precious, coal, diamonds, everything. About 8 years ago, I was running the metals and mining strategy project at your best friends, Joe at Wood Mackenzie. And trying to integrate their metals and mining and their energy business a little bit. And you know, the factory sector seemed to be a good upcoming sector way of doing that. So sort of started them on that path. And from there, I came across Benchmark Mineral Intelligence. At the time, they only did sort of pricing and events and journalism. So I went in and we launched all of their forecasting and consultancy side, building out supply demand models, long-term forecasting, etc. Was there for about 5 years before getting made redundant because I started costing a bit too much. And I was going to go into industry, but you know, my wife was on maternity leave. It was a sad story. You know, just having had our second child, she was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. So she was going through some pretty brutal combined chemo and radiotherapy. And all the job offers I were getting were coming with a 4-year equity vesting commitment. And you know, at that time, I wasn't in a position to take that. So people kept asking me for work. So I started doing consultancy under the SC Insights brand. And then people started saying they wanted to come and work with me. So I started bringing people on to work under the brand. And It's just been this sort of, then we realized, we didn't have any data, so we had to hire people to get the data in and rebuild all of these databases that I'd done before. And yeah, it's just been this sort of organic journey to bring us to where we are today at SC Insights.
And if you could just give a little more color into what SC Insights does for clients.
Yeah, so the three main things. The first is we do a lot of asset level due diligence. So when people are looking to invest in part of the supply chain, we'll go in, kick the tires, do all the economic forecasts, comparative analysis of the industry, that type of thing, valuation, sensitivity analysis. We also do that for some of the big debt capital raises. People financing, multi-billion dollar battery plants and things like this. And then we then also do a huge amount of term sheet advisory. So, as you know, not a lot of things outside of China in the supply chain get built without some kind of take or pay offtake contract. And we advise people on what the structures of those should be, what the options are when it comes to those term sheets. In lithium, that could be looking at termination clauses, start dates, what prices to use, discounts, floor and caps, things like this, and going over some of the pitfalls people can fall into when signing those. And then finally, we've built out over the past year our regular research offerings. We've also got our supply demand forecasts, online portal, price forecasts, contract databases, financial models, all things like this as well, which, if you're interested in, feel free to reach out and organize a demo, put a little pitch in there.
Nothing wrong with pitching. 2023 probably was the most dramatic year that I've seen in the lithium industry in 33 years. I don't know what your perspective is. That's why I'm going to ask you about it. But we've seen the drop in prices and we've seen just incredible negative sentiment. What's your assessment of what happened in 2023? And where we're going in 2024.
So, I think 2023 was really a rebalancing of the market. And, I know you've heard me speak before about when we look at this supply chain, we need to look at each individual stage of it. Because what's happened is on the battery production capacity side, that's got into massive overcapacity. The cathode side is in massive overcapacity. This is one of the features, by the way, of the China building industries without properly planning who they're going to sell the material to. You've then got a lot of destocking across the supply chain. You've got a huge amount of really high cost material coming in, and the capacity in China to process that high cost material and prices that could justify processing that high cost material that led to an oversupply in the market. And then you've sort of got, this cascading through. Prices decline. Well, to be honest, we're still at historically high levels. They're not through the floor. But you've got to look at it in the context of, at the same time, having huge increases in cost inflation. And that's something which takes longer to rebalance than pricing. Prices can spin on a dime, but your production costs are going to change more gradually. And that's a position a lot of people are in now. They've seen this huge cost increase. And they were producing very expensive tons of material across the supply chain because they still make money at doing it. And now they don't make money at doing those things. So they have to walk it back a little bit. And, these things happen in markets all the time. It's probably the first time it's happened in lithium to this degree. But yeah, it's part of the course, I guess, of what's kept me in this industry for 20 plus years.
Did it surprise you how fast the lepidolite and African LCEs got to China?
It did. There were sources of supply popping up that we didn't think would be sources of supply ever. So, all of these, tantalum tailings in Ethiopia and places like that that somehow made it to China. Yeah, that was surprising for us. It's almost impossible to track unless you speak to the Chinese refineries and say, what are you processing? What? You actually buy this stuff from LinkedIn? But yeah, they were. And likewise, perhaps less of a surprise on the Chinese lepidolite side, and we'll talk a bit about that later, I think, because you know there's more than one type of Chinese lepidolite. There's a big difference between what is almost artisanal and what is more, industrial scale mining on the lepidolite side. But yeah, there's a surprise on the upside, but it sort of goes to the adage that high prices solve high prices. You bring in this huge amount of material, but it increases, it pushes up the cost curve. So if you've got a low cost operation, it's actually a good thing for you.
Well, if we hearken back to Albemarle's comments from their earnings call, I think they put the number at what they believe is currently underwater capacity-wise that is having to sell below their cost is about 200,000 tons. Do you think that's in the ballpark?
So, I would say that a lot of that 200,000 tons has already left the market. A lot of that supply coming from Africa no longer comes from Africa. The Chinese lepidolite supply, some of the artisanal stuff may well not reopen after the Chinese New Year. We've seen this in other markets before that, domestic Chinese supply can be, very fickle, particularly at this time of year when it's winter and the ground's frozen, that if they're not making money, they're not going to go back to mining. So I think some of that will drop out. The 200,000 number seems about right for the amount of supply which is underwater at the moment. But I say I think a lot of that will have already stopped or stop in the next month or so.
Last month, you did a lithium deep dive that I found useful, and you spoke about the demand story still being intact, which I'd just like to cover that briefly. Where do you see, and I like just looking at gigawatt hours. It's easier than trying to put a spreadsheet together with every EV model and predicting how many are going to sell. What do you see for gigawatt hours in 23, or what did you see? And then how do you look at 2024?
Yeah, so we had 2023, we had about 960 gigawatt hours there. We've got 1.2 terawatt hours in 2024. So, that's about 30% growth. Now, the transportation sector, we've actually got lower than that, about 25% growth. So you have to remember that, when lithium prices were sky high, they're actually destroying a lot of demand. They were destroying demand from the energy storage sector. So that energy storage sector now is absolutely booming. And these guys couldn't buy cells previously. There wasn't enough. We weren't in overcapacity. Now we are, so they can buy them. If you look at the change in energy market dynamics in Europe since, Russian gas being cut off, the amount of solar going up in China is phenomenal. In Europe, it's phenomenal. In the US, it's phenomenal. And these guys are wanting to put batteries in, to avoid the so-called duck curve in pricing and take advantage of that. And yeah, that side of the demand story is great. The EV side of the demand story is still strong. By 2030, we've got our market getting to, 4.2 terawatt hours. So there's been a big change in sentiment. Don't get me wrong, but the demand story is still there. A couple of companies slowing down is not an industry slowing down. They're reacting to competition.
Well, I was going to ask you about this in detail later, but this seems like a good opening. Sodium ion. When lithium price was going through 40,000, 50,000, 60,000, that was the narrative that sodium ion's going to come and at least an ESS eat lithium's lunch, and then it would start to move in on the low end of the EV market. At $15 to $20 a kilo lithium chemicals, where do you see sodium ions place?
Yeah, I mean, sodium ion is going to role to play in the market, but for us, it's very much a China versus a non-China story. And going back to my earlier point about long-term contracts and planning, you're not building in this supply chain without a long-term offtake contract outside of China. And at the moment, there is nobody outside of China who's writing a long-term offtake contract for sodium-ion batteries in any industry, right? They're going to see what happens in China first. Now, in China, we do have about, 150 gigawatt hours of pretty credible capacity in the pipeline for sodium-ion that's being built. There's a lot more uncredible capacity that's been announced. But, it's not an unreasonable amount. We have to wait and see what that performance will be like in vehicles and in energy storage markets, because there are different issues when it comes to it. In theory, it should be cheaper, and if you're purely looking at the cost dynamics, which is actually less important in automotive than it is in energy storage, then yeah, it could take a reasonable amount of market share, because theoretically those batteries can get to a cost of $50 per kilowatt hour. It's very difficult to get below $60 per kilowatt hour for LFP type batteries, and almost impossible to get below 70 really in NCM type cathodes. In the long term, we've got it with like 5 or 7% of the market. It could be more, but if it is going to be more than that, it's a long way.
Zolandes offers technology and services that support both direct lithium extraction and conventional evaporation ponds. Minimize the environmental impact of your lithium site through Zolandes' data-driven insights and tailored solutions for each extraction method. Go to zolandes.com for more information. That's ZELANDEZ.com. Let's go back to 2023 for a second. The oversupply narrative, how much of the lithium oversupply do you think was drawdown across the supply chain of just lithium in the form of lithium in cells, lithium in the form of lithium in cathode, which made the Chinese able to say, hey, we don't need chemicals this month because we're drawing down what we've got? What, if you look at what happened last year, how much do you just think was the bloated supply chain being leveraged? And how much was the other resources that we already agreed came more quickly than either one of us thought?
To be honest, almost all of it. Because you have a situation where you've got inventory and prices are falling, that inventory is losing you money. You need to ship it as quickly as possible. And also, Chinese businesses, quite often when they're conversion businesses, historically have really poor cash flow. So, if they're not making money, they're not going to buy something. And then you've got, everybody not wanting to catch the falling knife, as it were, which has left them with razor thin inventory levels at various parts of the supply chain, particularly lithium refiners. And that's why we call the sort of nadir of lithium prices most likely was actually in January this year. And, they sort of bobbed along since then. We'll see if there's a change of direction after the new year. But yeah, I think most of it was just that inventory readjustment inside of China. Outside of China, you've got a different trend happening. And that is that, again, most of these lithium units are done on long-term contract into, supply chains going into VW, Ford, GM, Tesla, whoever. And those guys are looking at the future and saying, hang on, yeah, prices are coming down, that's good for demand, but it means I'm going to make less money per unit. And also I'm going to face a lot of competition from Chinese exports, because they've got all these great electric cars coming out, and what the advantages that Tesla had in not being a legacy auto. And they are cutting their optional volumes. So when you have these contracts, you're not saying necessarily I'm going to take 10,000 tons. You say I'm going to take up to 10,000 tons, of which I'll guarantee I'll take 7,000 tons. And those 3,000 tons are starting to go missing, or missing from a ship. They're still in a warehouse somewhere waiting to be sold. And that's putting pressure on the market outside of China. That, we do have this oversupply. It's not huge. Inventory levels are not massively high. If you look at inventory levels in lithium, they're nowhere near the sort of days of consumption that you get in copper or aluminium or, sorry, aluminum or anything like this.
We've got a world that is still, especially at the spodumene level, China centric. I mean, there really isn't another game in town yet, aside from what the Aussies are trying to do in Kemerton and Kwinana. How long do you think it's going to take real conversion capacity to be developed outside of China? And this cycle that we've just seen would seem to me to not be a positive for that happening.
Yeah, so there's two ways to look at it. I mean, you've got the volumes that are trading, and then you've got the volumes that are being contracted. So if you look at the sales, long-term sales conversations that people are having at the moment, that's with all of the refining capacity going up in Europe and North America. And in that respect, it's already a large part of the market. In terms of the material actually flowing, tons flowing around the supply chain, you're probably looking at 26, 27 before that happens. You have to remember that a lot of the refining projects have been stalled because they couldn't find any raw material because no one wanted to sell them the raw material. Why risk it? Why risk it on a company that hasn't been built yet? Now the power is a bit more in those refinery projects' hands. You're starting to see some more offtake deals being penned. So I think they'll move forward. They've got their offtake contracts themselves from automotive companies and cell facilities, which are being constructed at the moment, fully financed at the moment. So, those supply chains are growing. Not everyone will make it. We always knew that. But yeah, this is, I guess we're getting a bit of a shakeout of the who will be the winners and the losers. And in all of these markets, it's not really the best projects that the winner who makes the best winner makes the winners. It's the guy who lands the deal.
Well, you've got a situation where if you go back 7 or 8 years ago, Greenbushes was really the only operating mine that wasn't a niche mineral play. And now you've had the massive expansion in WA. How do you see that developing? Do you see a return of a more of a balance between hard rock and brine? Or do you think because hard rock comes on quickly, and then that'll lead into the inevitable DLE question when you're finished with that?
So, I think one of the really important points, both to that question and when we talk about high cost supply, is if you're an independent refiner in China, you have a choice as to what raw material you get now. Now, are you going to buy the really high cost stuff from LinkedIn or even really low grade lepidolite that's going to tear your refinery apart? Or are you going to buy a nice, 5.5%, 5.7% spodumene, which lowers your production cost? Well, yeah, that material still has demand for it. So, I think those hard rock plays are still going to win out. The fact that they can come to market a little bit quicker and a slightly lower CapEx essentially makes them lower risk. So, yeah, I think the future is not as bright as it was, but it's still pretty positive for a lot of these hard rock projects. When it comes to brine, so we'll start with the sort of continental brines. That becomes a little bit more political because Chile is now a DLE focused brine producer. Bolivia will continue to shuffle along very slowly. A lot of the US brines, as you kind of have the same opinion, are not, despite having potentially high lithium parts per million, are not really suitable for DLE. You've got much cleaner brines with lower PPMs out there, which are a lot easier to clean up. And yeah, in Argentina, I'm bullish on Argentina. I'd love to see a lot more of those projects successful and move forward. It's their own race to lose. We'll see if the government comes in and messes that up. Hopefully they won't, and we'll continue to defer to the provincial governments.
We're in a world now, and again, I'll use an Albemarle number since they're very recent, and I relatively agree with them anyway, that in a world where growth is going to be between 250,000 and 300,000 tons a year, which is more than the largest lithium company the world produces in a year right now. How do you see the globe adjusting to that level of demand and sourcing shakeout, where you have North America wants their own supply chain, EU wants their own supply chain? How quickly can we have a world that accommodates both what China's doing and what those outside of China are attempting to do?
It's going to be difficult. I did a very slapdash piece of analysis recently that show, we bought on 500,000 tons or so in the last 5 years at an average price of $30,000 a ton. And we need to bring on double that amount in the next 5 years, and the current price is $15,000 a ton. And production costs have gone up. And you want to get it from a higher cost source now. And you want to add on all the ESG side of things. Well, it doesn't work. Something's got to give in that. And I don't think it's going to be trying to move away from China when it comes to Europe and North America. If anything, they'd rather slow down the energy transition and the targets before giving up too much industry to China. But yeah, I mean, the prices need to increase. We're below the incentive price to bring a lot of these new projects online. You've got two ways of looking at price. You've got the price that keeps you operating, and you can say, well, we're broadly at that level. Most people aren't having to close, some are, but not all. But it's very difficult when you're not making a huge margin to then say, right, I'm going to double production straight away. Can I have another couple of billion dollars, please? So that's it's going to be difficult, and it's going to be take quite a lot of convincing for some of these financial organizations to finance the supply chain.
Yet even with the price dropping by order of magnitude, you have the iBanks coming out with forecasts that still show, many of them still show, significant oversupply, even in this pricing environment. I'll just ask the question in a pejorative way, I guess, but why are lithium forecasts in general on the supply side, why are they so bad?
I could talk about this for hours, but I mean, one of the simplest ways to put it is, you do this as well as me, but one of the most boring parts of our job is doing the lithium supply numbers. Right? This was a lot easier when there were 20 producers, a lot harder when there's 300, potential producers out there. And I've seen it happen at the companies I've worked for that, you give the boring job to the new guy. And these guys aren't necessarily as experienced. And that happens in particularly in banking as well. So you end up with supply forecasts which are a lot closer towards company targets and press releases, which we know from being cynical and having been around are pretty unlikely to happen. And that gives you this oversupply. The other thing that they struggle with is just looking at the fundamentals of a market where demand is growing by 20 odd percent every year for years and years and years. It's never happened in copper, it's never happened in iron ore, it's never happened in gold, it's never happened, even happened in oil. So, it's very difficult for people to understand what prices are needed to incentivize that level of production. You really need to look at what corporates need to justify that investment versus, other investments that they could make. So again, I think people are perhaps a little bit unrealistic in their forecasting on the impact of prices on potential supply. And then you've also got, there are things like, defunding of a lot of commodity research and investment banks because of MiFID II rules. You have a lot of people basically with just methodologies that are demonstrably false. So, I've seen some of the, bulge bracket investment banks put out price forecasts where inventories go negative. I mean, that's a physical impossibility. What's a negative inventories? Like an empty warehouse somewhere. If you're going to do that, you had to destroy demand. And well, if you're destroying demand and people say, I'm not going to build a car because I can't source my lithium, well, we know what the price will do then. It will go towards 100. Now, I'm not saying that will happen again, but that's what the logic of a lot of these forecasts said. So, yeah, a lot of them are just demonstrably false. And I think it comes down to a lack of experience, to be honest.
Do you see China as being very difficult to get accurate information out of, being moderately difficult? How do you get your China info, and what level of confidence do you have when you hear something?
Yeah, I mean, we have our analysts on the ground in China, and we also use this artificial intelligence program, which if anything, it's good at making bullet point lists and translating the Chinese better than most analysts can. So what we do is we get these lists of all the capacity announcements, and then we go and check them. So that the human goes and checks it. The problem is, you think they're optimistic, and then they actually end up being pessimistic with what actually happens on the ground. For us, the way around that is you look at the economics of it, and there's always a little bit of flex in the economics, and these resources can lose money for a little period of time. But if they're losing money, you're not going to double your production. And actually, I think on the supply side with China, we've got a pretty good handle on it. The bigger issues I have are actually not on the lithium production, but just the sheer scale of some of the cathode and cell production expansions just make zero sense to me. We look at the market in oversupply, we know it's in oversupply, and people selling cells at cost or even below cost, and then still announcing expansions. And we worked out that even with our forecast, there's about 300 gigawatt hours of capacity, cell production capacity, that won't produce this year because it won't have a home. It's insane. And we go back and check. One of the other things that we do is we cross-check with satellite imagery, because we've got a map that locates all of the assets. We have to check whether they're there. Sometimes we find that parts of the Chinese supply chain are actually resellers and not existing producers, or it's not a factory. We can't see a factory, or it's not a mine. We can't see a mine. That person's never going to admit to being a reseller, but they are. That sometimes inflates the Chinese numbers.
That's always been the case in China.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I don't know about other industries, but it was true even 20 years ago in lithium, that there were people that purported to be producers that were just reselling. When you look at the rest of this decade, and China's trying harder and harder to get more of their lithium domestically, what percent do you think of their own demand can be supplied from, whether it's spodumene, lepidolite, Qinghai brines, other brines? Where do you see that going?
So we looked this up yesterday, and we still didn't have China sourcing more than 30% of its own supply, globally maybe 15%, something like this. And the reason for that isn't because China doesn't want Chinese supply. Yeah, they want a little bit of Chinese supply. It's nice to have some local supply, but they're not massively endorsed with lithium compared to Australia, Latin America, or North America. But realistically, you just look at the economics of it, and they're not going to pay substantially more for these really low-grade ores that they can only process for, to get a chemical price of $20, $25 per kilogram, when they could source material from almost anywhere else in the world, and be producing at $15 or $10 per kilogram. Why would you do it? So, I don't see there being this, unless China gets cut off from the rest of the world, which I don't think will happen. People are saying we're going to have 300,000 tons of Chinese lepidolite production. I mean, we'll get to 300,000 tons of Chinese lithium production, sure, but why would you go after the expensive stuff when there's cheaper, lower hanging fruit?
What price do you think it would take for China to produce 300,000 tons of lepidolite? That's a backhanded way of asking a Cosgrove question, but.
So, there's a lot of materials we've been starting to leave the market, and that's the sort of low-grade lepidolite, low-grade African material that was producing in a $25,000 to $35,000 bracket, OPEX, right? That's OPEX. That means you stay open. It doesn't mean you build more. So if you want to incentivize that production, you're probably looking at $40,000 to $45,000 per ton. But we don't need prices at that level to meet that demand. I look at my spreadsheets and, if all of the projects get built, you've got over 5 million tons of LCE there a year, right? We've already discovered enough lithium for the energy transition pretty much. It's just a case of who gets built now. Now, there'll be projects that get discovered and still get built, and there'll be others that fall by the wayside and, you'll change, but we know there's enough lithium. So the question is, what lithium comes to market? And if you've got a choice, you're not going to go for the high cost supply. I think those expectations for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of tons of Chinese lepidolite, they just don't make sense. Why would Chinese refiners buy that crap?
Well, let me ask you another question on that same topic. When price got crazy and all this kind of garbage lithium started getting dug up, it seemed like nobody was talking about ESG. And when you look at a world where people purport to want traceability back to the asset, how do companies like BYD and CATL say, oh, we only sell clean lithium to the West, and it's none of your business what we do inside China. How do you see that playing out over the next 5 to 7 years with all the claims Western companies make about wanting ESG friendly critical metals?
So, when you look at things like the battery passport and the global one or the EU battery passport, they'll come in and you'll have the transparency and supply chain and you have all of your clauses in the contracts which go in already. So that's for the material you buy. That other supply chain that doesn't need that, doesn't need that audit. And that's what happens with artisanal cobalt already. You can buy it and guarantee it didn't come from the Congo, but it doesn't mean that material doesn't come from artisanal mining in the Congo anymore. That will continue. And we'll continue to buy it, right? We just won't buy it in cars. It'll continue to go into your mobile phone and your laptop and all these other things. But the newspapers only care about electric vehicles. They don't actually care about ESG credentials and human rights abuses. That's why they've never been writing about them until it comes to a lobbyist telling them, what about electric cars? I don't think there'll be that much of a change there. And call me cynical, but I tend to come down to the economic argument that you just don't need this really low quality supply. You don't want that cost pressure in your supply chain because you end up, producing a more expensive product. And I should also say, though, we don't put all the lepidolite in that 25 to 35 bracket. The more industrialized processes, Ganfeng, CATL, 414 mine, you're closer to, a $14 per kilogram cost with that material in our estimation.
Do you think that 2023 threw up a bit of a false flag to people looking long term? Because so much, as we've already discussed, of the supply came out of bloated inventories. And if you don't have a situation where you have a stuffed full supply chain, you can't rely on that bit. And you have to rely on the higher cost material. How do you see lithium growing up from a supply and from an industry perspective?
The first one is, people know that higher prices can bring more supply to the market. There's enough capacity to process it. That's great. And it steepens the cost curve for everyone else. But you can't rely on that high cost supply and you can't rely on reducing inventories. I think increasingly people will still need these long-term offtake contracts. They're going to need slightly better inventory management and inventory transparency across the supply chain. One of the things that we always look at is, what are the days of consumption of lithium inventory across the supply chain? And it's still tight. Prices may have declined, but it's still tight. And, you can't have the market in surplus and prices, going about, $10 or $12 or some of the lower end forecasts. It's impossible. It's actually impossible because you won't get the supply. People won't build new capacity. And when people say we're going to have a surplus till 2029, again, it's basically impossible because of the impact on the price. So, yeah, I mean, we're confident the price will recover. It has to for the demand story to continue. Otherwise, perhaps we do have to go to poorer batteries in the face of sodium ion because there won't be any lithium to go to the lithium ion capacity.
I never saw 45,000 tower lithium happening, and the run up was amazing. But it seems to me that we're going to have history repeat itself at least one more time before people get smart. I don't know how you feel about that. The narrative of the industry is, well, we want lower highs and higher lows, and that sounds great. And in an ideal world, that would happen. But if you stop investing and the kind of demand we're talking about happens, what prevents this cycle from repeating itself 2 years down the line or 18 months down the line?
That's how markets operate. They're very bad at forecasting themselves. They're very bad at matching supply and demand. Potentially, it gets a little bit easier when you have futures trading, when that gets liquid, because at least you can manage your price risk. You can manage your supply risk with long-term offtake contracts, and there are ways to mitigate risk that we advise our clients on quite regularly. They'll increase in the future, but my advice to anybody buying lithium is don't rely on the market, rely on yourself. Because the market's going to go crazy. And if you look at it, the automotive producers who are involved in the supply chain, the battery producers involved in the supply chain, they never paid more than $50 per kilogram for their lithium.
Right.
It was the energy storage guys who didn't know what they were doing who were paying $70,000, and the people they were buying it from, they didn't pay $70,000 for it. They just told them they did. So a lot of people made money from lithium from that run up. The people who lost money were the consumers, and ultimately, the customers of these products.
This episode is also brought to you by Mississippi Lime. Are you looking for the highest purity calcium products to produce battery quality chemicals? Look no further than my friends at Mississippi Lime. That's limeforlithium.com. LIME, the number 4, LITHIUM.com. You and I have spoken about the difference between the supply chain in Korea and Japan versus China. And if you look at the data, and I, people hate it when I quote this, price from November to December for carbonate in Japan went up when everybody was saying, well, it has to go down because the numbers in the index go down. And for the year, it averaged over 50,000. And yeah, Japan's not the market it used to be, but Korea behaved essentially the same, except for it was flip-flop between hydroxide and carbonate price-wise. How attached to spot price do you find those contracts? I mean, you can't get into details because you advise people on how to design their floors, and I'm privy to some of that information. But as a general statement, how do you see this difference in 24 and 25? Are contracts going to get better? Or where do we just stay in this world where China's China and everything else is everything else?
I think you're certainly going to keep the differentiation between China and the CIF Asia price, which is the reference for most of the rest of the world. If anything, it's going to get a little bit more complicated because the negotiating power has changed from the buyer to the seller. And so you have to look at what the seller wants. And the seller, quite frankly, sorry, what the buyer wants. The buyer doesn't want volatile prices. They don't want this headache. So if they can push you to a fixed price because you need it to get financed, then they will. So, and if you're looking to produce, if you say the winner isn't the best project, it's the guy who gets built, the guy who does the deal, you may take that for your first operation because then you get built. And you know, the great thing about this market, it doubles every 4 years. You have to make your money 4 years later when you've doubled your production and you're much safer bet. So I think there will be more fixed pricing. Maybe you know most of it will still be linked to fast markets, CIF Asia price. Don't really see any of the China domestic pricing being used outside of China. It's more a pricing negotiation play. And then hopefully we'll start getting a bit of liquidity on the futures exchanges because you know that basically helps everybody. And that you know even if you're a producer thinking this is nothing to do with me. If people can hedge their exposure to you, then it lowers your cost of capital, reduces the risk for people investing. So hopefully that works out. But yeah, it's been a mess for a long time. It's going to stay a mess. Fine by me. That's where I make a lot of my money. So.
Okay, so we're probably destined for continued volatility in your mind. Is that a fair summary of what we've just said?
Yeah. And you know, I think it's you know, we've supply, demand, prices, and cost. You know, you're almost constantly chasing your tail, trying to figure out which one's influencing the other. So for us, it's you know, say looking at the financials, looking at the economics of the industry. If there's one thing that Chinese industries is consistent on, it is it doesn't like not making money. So or any industry really. So you know that's what we focus on. It you know it means you get mismatches in supply and demand and price volatility, but that's life.
Well, in one of your answers, you made a point I'd like to tease out a little more. If you go back to 2016, 2017, when some of the projects in Western Australia were trying to get financed, they signed up for long-term, quote unquote, market-based pricing, and they probably tied it to the worst performing index they could have, which would be internal hydroxide in China. And people have suffered because of that.
People setting prices on trade data, you know, that was quite common, and some of that data was not quite manipulated, but you could see people trying to hide what they were putting on the bills of lading. Ultimately, price transparency is what the market needs. It's a little bit more difficult in lithium because it doesn't yet trade as a commodity. You know, it's not homogeneous. You can't go out and buy your hydroxide from anybody. It's, you know, it's a 6 to 18 month process to change supply, right? So, you know, it means it doesn't trade that way. It means your hands are tied a little bit when it comes to managing the supply chain.
Okay, well, we're about 50 minutes in, so I better start winding this down. But I do want to ask you, what's your sense of how long it takes North America to have a legitimate volume of supply from North American resources?
The price environment at the moment obviously doesn't help. And the fact is, a lot of these companies now have to redo their engineering studies and under a lower price environment. It's a bit of a shame because it actually delays a lot of these projects by 12 months for no particular reason or no good reason. I'm still very bullish on the US. And, you know, I think there's a huge number of assets that we track there. That said, you know, I think to get to 30,000 tons, we're not until like 2027 here. That said, it goes up pretty quickly after that. Canada gets to 30,000 tons 2026, maybe. So, you know, they're still kind of immaterial players in the market at that stage. I said the assets are good. I think that the big thing for me is probably looking at the Smackover formation and whether the dealing technologies work with those brines, because then that could be quite scalable quite quickly. So I'm quite bullish on those. But there's a lot of nice hard rock assets. Some of the other hard rock assets, which are a little bit further away from production, sort of South Dakota type, spodumene ore, pegmatites, they're just going to be pushed back by a couple of years now, just from a financing perspective.
And then there's the always important, when does recycling make a material difference in lithium supply?
So if you define materiality as, say, 5%, we've got that in 2025, like 6% in 2025. And then, sort of steadily increasing. It's actually quite predictable because we've got so many recycling projects. We've got the legislation coming in for it. But it doesn't really drive the market until, by the time we get to sort of 50%, 2045, And even then, you still need primary investment. So, in our working lifetimes, we are not going to stop seeing mining investment. And you have to remember, a lot of the recycling supply is either a function of process scrap, or it is, 10, 12 years before it comes back to the market quite often. And the market 12 years ago, it's like a couple of crappy Prius batteries coming in. We didn't have much lithium in them anyway.
What are you seeing as trends with all the new players trying to get into gigafactories? The scrap scenario, how much for how long? I mean, some of these guys, especially when they first went to Europe, there was one plant over there in Poland, I believe, that was running 50% scrap for months or something in that
That's
range.
common in ramp up. It's getting slightly better now as the equipment's getting better. You get more oxidization in the plants, but generally you don't get below sort of 10-15% split rate coming off, and that material is quite valuable. That's like cathode on foil. So you got all of that, goodies. It's not in a big plastic box which somebody glued together because they couldn't afford screws anymore, and it's consistent. So that process scrap is going to be the foundation of the recycling industry, and it makes sense for recycling to happen along with battery production, and then to have the hub and spoke model that brings in end of life material. And the economics of that, it varies. The economics of recycling an LFP battery are substantially worse than recycling an NCM111 battery, which is the best you can get from a recycling point of view. So, it's an industry that will exist. We know there'll be enough capacity to process the material. We know the material will need to be processed. The only really unanswered question is whether they'll make any money.
Yeah, I think that's where legislation will have its place in forcing it to happen.
And they've got to decide whether, if you're a recycling company, whether you want to take whole commodity price risk, or whether you want to be a toll refiner and give that risk to somebody who takes commodity price risk anyway.
And starting to close this down, what do you think are the, if you're advising somebody who's just learning about the lithium space, what are the top two or three trends over the rest of this decade that you'd tell them to look at?
The demand side, I've said it for many years, it's a political mandate. This isn't a consumer choice. It's a political mandate that is mandating basically electric vehicles, clean technology, grid storage, etc. That's the demand story. That's what you want to keep an eye on, because it's possible for the first time we'll see some walk back on that with all the elections happening across the world this year. As I say, it's seen that this move, political move towards zero emissions vehicles, is favoring China too much, then people will start pushing back the targets for full electrification or full zero emissions of the fleet. Other than that, it's keeping an eye on, there's going to be a lot of supply, there's going to be a lot of winners. It's just trying to pick those winners and having your view as to what makes a winner. And as I say, it's not the best project, it's not the best grade, it's not just the best management team. It's a combination of these things, and quite often it's blind luck as to whether the five or six things that you need in your financing and your permitting and your court cases and all of these things just coming together at once and staying together for long enough to get a final investment decision to get the funding through.
What did I miss? What questions should I have asked you that I have failed to do?
I don't think you asked me my price forecast for this year.
I didn't think you'd give me one, but I'd love to hear that number.
Well, I said we've already said we think we've had the floor when it comes to sort of carbonate pricing. I think it'll go up, so I'd say, probably 16 to 17 would be an annual average, ending the year stronger than now. I wouldn't be surprised to see prices touching 20 again. I don't think they can go much higher than that, though, just because there is still, there's plenty of places to buy lithium chemicals. There's plenty of places to buy spodumene at the moment. So it'll take a while for that to tighten up. But as I say, I think we've seen the nadir, and if we haven't, then put all your money into lithium stocks because it's going to go stupid high again. Not investment advice. I'm not allowed to invest in lithium stocks, so yeah, don't take my advice.
If you were going to look 2 or 3 years out, do you see that staying in a narrow band between 16 and 22, or do you see a potential run up just because investment didn't get made and
I think that the range will be slightly higher than that, would be my view. Probably, our long-term forecast, like 24,000 to incentivize production. Yeah, it'll be volatile. And volatile, not just, it's not just the supply-demand balance that drives pricing. It's also the stocking and restocking cycle, because inventory levels across the supply chain, haven't been built up for decades. They're not very big. So that you can effectively have a deficit market and prices going up, and you're going to have a surplus market price going down just because of restocking. And there is a little bit, when we look at the spot price of the tail wagging the dog. So the actual tons which control the price is a lot smaller than the size of the total market.
all right, sir. I appreciate your time. Let me ask you a few rapid fire questions.
Go for it.
Last book you read?
God, I don't read many books. Oh no, it was a Winnie the Pooh book to my kid.
I've had that answer before. I think I
Okay.
had that answer very, very recently, actually. What's your favorite city outside of the UK?
Outside of the UK, I love Hong Kong. I love Singapore. What in the US? I like San Francisco. I'd love to come and check out some of the fine cities in North Carolina, though, as well.
What is your favorite word in any language?
Denada. It's nothing.
Get it. I guess finally, the age-old and some people feel tired question of if you could have dinner with anyone that ever lived in the sentient form, who would it be and why?
Oh, I should have prepared for that answer. With you, Joe, with you. And we've had dinner before, so
Yeah.
it's a re-invite.
Good answer. Andy, thank you very much. Deeply appreciated.
Thanks a lot, Joe.
And there you have it. I enjoyed that conversation very much. I think there was a lot of great information, and I think many of you will listen to this episode more than once. 2024 shapes up to be one of the most interesting years in the history of lithium. For those of you that don't like to hear personal commentary, you might want to switch off now. I am going to say a few words about something that happened in my life over the last month. I spent January in my hometown. Normally, I go up there to ski and watch the Bills lose in the playoffs, see relatives, watch some college basketball. This time, I was confronted with the last few weeks of my sister's life. My sister's name was Sheila Lowry Burl. She was 75 years old when she died. She was a huge influence in my life. And why do I bring a personal matter into the podcast? I guess because one of the things that I like to do is to tell people that perspective is one of the most important things you can have in investing. And the death of a loved one really brings what's important to the fore in your life. And I love doing this podcast. I've had a great ride in the lithium world, but when confronted with the passing of a sister, it does put things in perspective. And while this may be the ramblings of someone who has just experienced a significant loss, I would suggest to you that you look around your world and make it clear to those that you value and love that they know. Thanks again for listening.